We'll begin this morning, begin our week, talking about Russia and Russian politics and the relationship between Russia and the United States. And we are fortunate to have with us as a guest a reporter who has spent quite a bit of time covering Russia and other places as well. Our guest this morning is Serge Schmemann. He's deputy foreign editor for The New York Times. He's been a reporter since 1971 and a foreign correspondent since 1977. He covered a number of very big stories, the decline and collapse of communism, the transition to majority rule in Zimbabwe, the nuclear catastrophe at Chernobyl, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the reunification of Germany, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, and the peace struggle in Israel. He's won a number of awards for his work, including the Pulitzer Prize he received for coverage of the reunification of Germany. He's here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk in the MillerCom series talking about Russia tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. It's sponsored by a number of units on the campus, including the Russian and East European Center. And we're fortunate that he's given us a little bit of his time this morning to talk about some of these very issues. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, we're certainly welcome your questions. All we ask callers is that people try to be brief. We ask that so we can keep things moving along, include as many callers as possible. Anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Last year, when Boris Yeltsin announced that he would be stepping down early and announced that Vladimir Putin would act in his stead, one thing that seemed obvious about Mr. Putin was that this gave him a great advantage over anyone else in the presidential elections that were going to come. But it seemed that at the time, many people, including even people whose special area of study was Russia, were asking this question, who is Vladimir Putin? And it seems to me that all along, people continue to ask the question. As recently as last May, when President Clinton was there, when the analysis I read of the trip and the issues and so forth continued to make this point that, and not only to us in the West, but even to Russians, Mr. Putin was still something of an enigma. What really do we know about this man? Is it possible to answer that question? Who is Vladimir Putin?
Well, I'm sure we'll be asking this question as long as he's in power. You know, I think most of us are still wondering who Yeltsin was. He also never really, despite the fact that he wrote a book of memoirs, it never became totally clear. But I think a certain image of Putin is emerging, and I have to confess I find it a rather promising one for Russia. What we've had in Russia since the collapse of communism 10 years ago is a lurching back and forth. You know, the first wave was the reformers. You know, you had people like Gaidar and Chubais and people who were sort of young and had plenty of Western ideas and, you know, damn communism, full steam ahead. And, of course, they led to certain fairly catastrophic results, the development of this crony capitalism, the mafia. There have been countless elections, but no real democracy has set in. And then there was a backlash, nostalgia for Russian power, for stability, for security. And so I think Putin, in a way, represents the synthesis of the various trends we've been watching in Russia. He is, on the one side, a very Soviet man. He was a KGB agent, abroad. He believes in a strong Russia. He believes in a strong centralized Russia. At the same time, he's a young man. He, quite possibly because of his service in the KGB, because of his life abroad as a KGB agent, he's also conscious of the need for economic change, for the need for some form of democracy, for participatory democracy. And therefore, he has brought these two strands together in ways that often mystify us. You know, he will wage the war in Chechnya, a scorched earth policy, which I think many of us find horrible, the way he is going about it. And he's not going to step back from that. He is trying to reimpose central control. He's trying to bring the oligarchs under control to tax them. This will be a very difficult battle. But at the same time, you know, he's a man who has impressed everybody with his familiarity with issues, with the degree to which he sort of thinks issues through. He had dinner with a group of journalists in New York the other night, and they were all very impressed at his candor. He was speaking about the submarine that sank, and he was totally willing to admit that he had messed it up, that the public relations factor had been mishandled. He's been very skillful in waging the control against the missile defense, sort of asserting Russia's interests. So to me, he is probably what Russia needs at this time, somebody who will try to restore some national pride, some national purpose, and some control. The form of decentralization that had taken shape in Russia, the governors who were running their provinces like personal fiefdoms with total corruption, these oligarchs who have never paid a cent in taxes and basically strip everything they get a hold of. These things have to be brought back under control. But I do not see him as a man who will ever try to reimpose the sort of authoritarian thought control that characterized the Soviet era.
Hmm. Certainly, he came into office facing some significant challenges, and you pointed to a number of them: problems with the economy, the Chechen War continues, difficulties over arms control issues in the relationship between the U.S. and the United States, a significant demographic issue that Russia is facing, as some other nations are, very very high expectations, and a number of disappointments as well. And the Kursk incident of the Kursk just one seemed to be one in a long line. Is it too soon to rate his performance so far, or does one have to say that, given the kind of problems which he inherited and very high expectations, after having been in office such a short time, it would be unreasonable to expect very much change?
Oh, I think we have become very sober about our expectations of change, and more to the point, so have the Russians. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, after 10 years, people in Russia know that they're in for the long haul. And I think this is one of the advantages Putin will have. You know, he's not expected to do a quick 100 days and get the place on its feet. There is a total recognition that it's going to take a long time, a very long time. And I think in this case, his ratings continue to be very high. I think even his handling of the Kursk disaster earned him decent grades, because he was willing to admit publicly that they hadn't been aware of what had happened there, and to admit that this was a reflection of the sad state of affairs in Russia. He repeated that when the television tower burned in Moscow. He said, you know, this reflects where we are. And this kind of sort of admission, this sort of candor, I think, is welcome in Russia. I mean, Russians don't want to hear promises anymore. They want to be told an honest version: things are bad, let's get to work. And, you know, they do want to see some form of security returning to their lives. And I think he's found the right note for the Russians. He doesn't promise them anything, you know, that he can't deliver. He's going to have a hell of an uphill battle in coming years. These oligarchs are not going to give up their power easily. The governors are not going to give up their power easily. His, you know, purported contacts in the KGB are a mixed blessing. There are probably as many people there who hate him as who might support him. He has inherited a very corrupt administration from Yeltsin. But the advantage he has is that there are no more any illusions. You know, people know where he stands. They know what he has inherited. And he has developed a curious trust in Russia. His ratings are enormously high and continue to be high.
Just for a moment more to talk about the Kursk, when this happened, there was, and I think there continues to be, great deal of speculation on exactly what happened, and a number of theories have been advanced, some of them presumably by people who would at least be in the position to make an educated guess. Do we have anything more than educated guesses to offer on what happened?
We have more and more information provided by the Russians. In the beginning, there was a sense that the Russians were trying to give us, a version that suited their needs and that they were lying. I think more and more we realize it was confusion based on the solid evidence they had. Now that they've compared the evidence they had, the evidence that the United States has provided, a horrible event is emerging. Basically, the last report from Russia was that the entire front of the submarine blew away, and it's very dubious that anybody was alive for more than 2 minutes after that. It was a catastrophic explosion. What led to the confusion, I gather, is their first glimpses at the hole in which much of the metal was bent inwards, suggesting a collision. And they found, scattered metal on the seafloor. But from what I gather, metal being bent inwards can also be the result of the pressure that results after the explosion. I mean, all these things can, will await an investigation. But I think we are gaining the sense that their early statements and their early reaction was based more on confusion than on an attempt at cover-up. And we are coming to a stronger and stronger conclusion that what happened was a missile that went off inside the bay and set off a huge explosion among other missiles and basically blew the entire front of the submarine right off. Mm-hmm.
Our guest this morning in this first hour, Focus 580, Serge Shmaiman. He's a deputy foreign editor of the New York Times and has been a foreign correspondent with the Times for many years, covering many stories, including the collapse of communism. And he's here on the U of I campus to give a talk about Russia and the future of Russia in the Millercom series. That'll be tonight on the U of I campus. And, of course, anyone who's interested in attending is welcome to do that. It's free and open to the public. Anyone who's around town is welcome to go. And, of course, we're here to take whatever questions you may have. I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here we have a caller in Peoria, line 4.
Yes, good morning. The way to defeat communism is through the economy. Right now, Caterpillar Tractor Company is building small tractor in St. Petersburg, Russia. Now, what they'll do is that they'll trade their tractors for raw materials, which Russia has a lot of, and that's the way to defeat communism.
Thank you. I agree. It's a very interesting deal, a very promising one. It's I think the future of the sort of trade we'll be seeing in Russia, or the sort of manufacturing. And I think, as you suggest, what's important is that this is not simply an attempt to make a few quick bucks on Russia's resources, but to actually produce something in Russia that is useful to Russians and that actually creates jobs for Russians and transfers technology. So it is, I agree, a very promising and interesting deal, and I hope there will be many more such initiatives.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. As we have discussed, Russia certainly has fallen a long way from being one of the world's two superpowers to the place that it finds itself now. Given that fact, how do Russian people, your average Russian person on the street, how do they think about their country now and where they are and where they're going? And when they look for something to form the basis of sense of identity, what is it that they can reach for?
It's a very difficult question. I mean, I don't travel to Russia as much as I used to, but I do still keep in contact. because you really cannot speak any longer of a sort of Russian point of view. There are fierce debates going on in Russia. There are very divergent views on the role of Russia and its plight. It really depends who you ask. There are, of course, those who are nostalgic for great power. Empire was always a chief component of Russian nationalism, and I think many people feel that Russia is somehow a great power by right. It's a huge country. It's got nuclear weapons. It should have an army. But I think there are now many people who also feel that Russia has benefited by being downsized, you know, by losing the empire, which was a drain on its energies and resources. Right now, Putin has announced a 30% cutback in the military force, and there was no strong resistance. People don't want their kids to be going into this army anymore. So there are people who actually welcome the notion of Russia being scaled down to a more manageable package. You know, this is still a country that covers 11 time zones. It hasn't really become tiny. But I have not sensed a single opinion on the future, and this is reflected also in the Duma, in other agencies, and in the behavior of Putin, you know, who spends as much time just sort of trying to consolidate Russia as he does trying to restore some semblance of dignity. I'm not entirely sure Russians yearn to become the sort of superpower they had if the cost is to go back to the sort of system they had.
Hmm. President Putin, before he came president, one of the bases of his popularity was the way that he had conducted the war in Chechnya. It seemed, however, that this was a dangerous sort of issue to have one's popularity based on, because it's one of those things that could have turned sour real quick. And in fact, depending upon what had happened in the campaign period, it could have turned out to be to his disadvantage rather than to his advantage. It seems that, again, what I read is from Western opinion is that it's something that does not get the attention that it should, that and that, in fact, here in the West, we should be doing anything that we could to try to stop it, and that, in fact, maybe Mr. Putin doesn't really know what to do to stop it. Where is that headed?
I don't think there's much we can do to stop it. Russia has set out on the path of conquering Chechnya, which probably means destroying it. It's an issue that has, on which Russia has a very rare unanimity. There are people, you know, who hate it, who bemoan it, but there's only a handful of people who think Russia should just pull out. One reason for that, of course, is that after the first Chechnya War, as they call it, the earlier Russian incursion there, they did make peace. They did strike a deal. And then there was a sense that the Chechens took advantage of this and you know, continued to try to expand their influence, to try to expand this Islamic fundamentalism. There were explosions in Russia. There's some suspicion that these were done deliberately. We probably will never know the full truth. But the fact is that most Russians concluded the second time that they went in that this time you have to do it to the end. And Russians do have a stronger, perhaps, tolerance for long-term operations. The wars, the Caucasus wars of the last century lasted 100 years and people were prepared to wait. I think Putin has never really been politically threatened by the Chechnya War. It's something that everybody recognizes he has to pursue, and he will, and he'll wage it to a very bitter end. And there's, you know, the city Grozny has been wiped out. Thousands of people have been dislocated. But it was more our perception that he was threatened politically by this war. I really don't think he ever was. And any attempts by Westerners, by Western leaders to raise this issue have been met with sort of a stony disregard. I think they're determined to carry it through to the end. And I think our own administration in Washington has sort of decided if they're going to do it anyway, there's very little point sort of bashing their head against this wall. We're in for the long haul. We're in for an incredibly brutal and bloody scene, which we'll be hearing about again and again. And there's probably very little we can do about that. That's one of the truly horrible aspects of it.
I believe that it was just last week that people in Moscow marked the one-year anniversary of these bombings that helped to build support for a very aggressive prosecution of the war in Chechnya. A number of people were killed, and quote-unquote Chechen terrorists were blamed. I believe some people actually have been arrested. But I think that there always was some speculation floating around that, in fact, this was not the work of Chechens, that in fact, it was done by Russians who were interested in providing a reason to go back aggressively into Chechnya. Do we really know who was responsible for these acts, or will we, do you think, know convincingly?
I don't think we know, and I don't think we ever will. I know that the conspiracy theory is very strong in Russia, and there has been a lot of circumstantial evidence that's been produced, none of it totally convincing. They arrested some people, but we know very little about their trial, about what they did. I suspect we'll never know. It's an extraordinary thing to believe that, Russians would blow up their own building in order to go in after the Chechens. But stranger things have happened, and Russia has had a very brutal 10 years, and many Russians have shown a total disdain for human life in pursuing their own goals, including the gangsters and the mafia. So it's not totally impossible that that there was such a conspiracy, but it's one of these things, we don't know, and it's one of these things whose effects ended up being more important than the event itself. But it is one of the mysteries, I think, that many people will try to pursue, and possibly someday some archive will be opened and we'll see some inkling of what really happened.
I think that a lot of Russia watchers believe that, in part, the aggressive posture that the government has taken in Chechnya, it was intended to be a message to other people around the Russian Federation who had some interest in independence. And there are, as I read somewhere, and I hope this figure is correct, there are something like 27 million non-ethnic Russians living within the boundaries of the Russian Federation. And there are other places where people have expressed interest for greater autonomy, if not independence. Is that something that is likely to continue to be a challenge for the Russian government?
I don't know if Chechnya was also intended as a signal. There were areas like Tatarstan, the Tatar Republic, which opted for greater autonomy, but it never reached the level of an intention to fully secede. I think what made Chechnya unique among the republics was the huge concentration of sort of warlords, ganglords, who would escape to Chechnya. The Chechens controlled a large part of the black market in Moscow. And in the early days of, in the early post-Soviet era, they emerged as very strong mafia leaders in Moscow and controlled many aspects of the underground economy. And then they made of Chechnya an independent little fiefdom where they could run and be totally safe. People who went down there saw there was just this uncanny concentration of Rolls Royces and Ferraris and expensive cars. I mean, there really was that aspect, which is not often emphasized in our reports of the West, but it definitely was so. I remember this was in my time when I was still there. The real sort of connection with organized crime. And so I think originally the intention to crush Chechnya came in part as an intention to get control over these bandits. The Russians wanted to put a government they could control in charge in order to crack down on the mafias and banditry. And then this gradually went out of control and became mixed with Islamic fundamentalism and other factors. And this kind of situation really has not existed elsewhere. There are a few provincial governors who've become grotesquely corrupt, but they've never linked their corruption to a longing for independence. And I think that whole drive has ended. I think we now see everybody fairly certain that Russia will exist within the current boundaries, at least for the foreseeable future. In fact, it may expand. There's a strong chance that Belarus will rejoin Russia in some kind of federation. The irony there, it's the Russians who are resisting. There's a variety of reasons why they don't want Belarus to rejoin Russia, not least of which the incredibly unsavory figure who leads Belarus right now.
We're a little bit past the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580, and I would like to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Serge Schmemann. He is a deputy foreign editor with the New York Times and has worked for the Times for quite a few years. He was the Times bureau chief at various times, bureau chief in Jerusalem, in Moscow, in Bonn, in Johannesburg. Well, actually, that was when he worked for the AP. My apologies. He also, before working for the New York Times, he worked for the Associated Press as correspondent in Moscow, Johannesburg. He was correspondent at the United Nations. He has won a number of awards for his work, including the Pulitzer Prize, has covered a number of very big stories, including the collapse of communism, the catastrophe at Chernobyl, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the reunification of Germany, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. He's here visiting the campus. He's going to give a talk in the Millercom series talking about Russia's fate. That'll be tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Center. All these talks are always free and open to the public. There are many co-sponsors. The main sponsor here, in addition to the Miller Committee, is the Russian and East European Center on the U of I campus. Your questions certainly are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You have lived most of your life in the United States. Your parents, though, were born in Russia. Right?
No, actually, no? They were not. My grandparents were. We're third generation. Both of my parents were already born.
And you were born in Paris.
I was born in Paris, yeah. And then we came to the States in 51. Yeah. So I've ended up spending most of my life here, but 21 years working abroad. So I have to subtract that.
Well, the thing that I guess I am wondering about is in what way and how deeply you feel connected to Russia.
It was a very curious thing when we arrived there because you know, we grew up speaking Russian at home, but we never had that sort of emigre nostalgia, maybe because my parents weren't born there. I never had that sense that I was stripped of some kind of great wealth or privilege or right, or certainly no yearning to go back and live there. But we did speak Russian. We had been raised as Russians. My wife is also of Russian descent. And there was this very strange feeling when we first arrived of a great familiarity. You know, we felt, you know, we've been here in some kind of spiritual way. You know, it was just the way people talked, people walked, the stories they told. We had a nanny and the way she treated our kids. It was all very familiar. We realized that these really, you know, are to a degree the same people as we are and that we still share many traits, despite this long separation and despite, you know, three generations abroad. That was, of course, shaken severely by the way the Soviets treated American correspondents. You know, I was followed, I was bashed in the press, and they did everything possible to deny that I had any place or role or claim to the society. But we probably felt more at home there than other correspondents, simply because not even so much the language, which many correspondents mastered, as just a feeling of kinship with just the small things, just the way people walk down the street arm in arm, the countryside, which seemed familiar from all the stories we'd heard. You know, these things were all very much part of our childhood, even some of the foods, you know, we knew them well. So there was a sense of belonging, and for me it was expressed very strongly in a book I ended up writing about my efforts to find some roots and the way the Soviets reacted to it and what I did find. And it was called Echoes of a Native Land. And I think one of the remarkable experiences of working on the book was the degree to which Russians in the village that I worked in joined me in the search in the first years after the collapse of communism. They were as keen as I was to connect with their past. So in the beginning, it was very much a joint odyssey, and it was, you know, one of the finest experiences I've had working on this book.
You said that when you got to Russia, you had this feeling of familiarity, that somehow it felt right. And the thing I'm curious about is you said that you recognized perhaps traits in yourself that you also saw in the Russian people that you met. What would those be?
Well, you know, I had grown up, for example, listening to Russian fairy tales, and so just looking at Russian children's stores, you know, I recognized that, you know, we'd grown up on the same legends, on the same myths. I had grown up, for example, we pick mushrooms. Nobody in America picks mushrooms. We do, and there's tons of them here, for which people here pay huge amounts of money, and they're all available right in the backyard. And this was something, you know, I just found myself discussing with some people I meet, you know, what did you find? Where'd you find it? And just not even thinking this to be strange. There is a certain Russian appreciation of a warm day. I guess it comes from the long winter. On a summer day, there is a way Russians will just be in the sun with no further purpose. They will stroll slowly. There's also an enormous love of a very cold day when it's way below freezing and you feel very brisk and healthy. And all these things, I just remember the way, you know, my grandparents would say, ah, another nice, brisk, cold day. And so it just seemed normal to be treating these things as benefits. I mean, I'm giving you frivolous and trivial examples, but these are the small things in the texture of life that you don't even notice until you go somewhere and suddenly see that others share them with you. You know, I had never realized that they're part of a culture, the small little habits that you form that I had picked up from my parents. And even the intonations of speech, people who are bilingual or trilingual shift the cadence, shift their entire style of thinking when they shift languages. And I found that I fell very naturally into Russian cadences, that I could sort of pick up their rhythms of speech and fall into their patterns of speech. I wasn't translating either mentally or even socially. I knew what they were getting at, mm-hmm. Through all the little buzzwords. This was limited, of course. You know, there had been 70 years of communism. These people had developed certain priorities that were unfamiliar. For example, this perpetual search for something to buy, people walking around with a bag in the off chance of finding something. You know, obviously, this was not part of our life, the rudeness with which people dealt with each other in the stores, in the streets. I'm not talking about just passersbys, but, you know, anybody with the slightest bit of authority, a bus driver, a shopkeeper, always felt that they had the right to bully people who came in. You know, there were many such things which were very alien, very frustrating. But, you know, it was a combination. It was a combination of a certain familiarity and at the same time a certain Western frustration and even anger at times at the inefficiency, at the timidity, at the fear that people lived in. You know, this was very, very difficult to cope with.
Countries certainly are shaped by their national mythology. The United States is and has it. Ours is perhaps not as old as some other places, but we have it. In what way do the Russian myths shape the kind of outlook that Russian people have?
Oh, this is a huge subject. This is a huge one. And I think it's the key question. to be asking, because so many of our American illusions about Russia are based on our own mythology. We believe so strongly in the quick fix. We believe that anything that's broke should be fixed within a day or two. You know, we create huge scandals, fire two or three people, and move on. You know, in Russia, so much of the problem is not the is not something you can fix. It's something that's based in psychology, in mythology, as you say. I mean, Russians don't trust authority. They don't trust change. The whole survival strategy of the Russian village was to distrust anything that was being imported from outside. You grew as many potatoes as you could eat, but not so many that somebody would start attacking you for them. You kept a low profile, you know, and any time a reformer shows up and starts telling you, you know, here's emancipation, here's communism, here's collectivization, you just sort of smile politely and wait for them to go away. And I think it's very true with what we've seen since 1991. There is a profound distrust of free market, which Russians interpret as banditry, and that's roughly what they've seen. There is, you know, they vote all the time. They vote far more often than we do, but they've not formed political parties. It's still sort of voting for individuals. So the mentality, the whole psychology of the Russian man, of the Soviet man, is what needs to be transformed before there's any chance of moving on. It's happening, but it's a generational change. It's a slow change, and it certainly doesn't work by our Western rules. I think one of the most stunning examples I remember was the World Bank, which produced this whole program of, it was for Ukraine, you know, that they had to raise oil prices to world prices, and then they'd get exports and imports, and everything would be great. And the man who ran the program one day realized that if the Ukrainians followed this IMF program or World Bank, I forget which, they would freeze in 2 weeks. The whole country would freeze to death in 2 weeks if they listened to the West about raising oil prices. So, you know, our prescriptions are very rarely applicable unless they look very deep into where Russia comes from.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. And again, our guest, Serge Schmemann, he's a deputy foreign editor for The New York Times and has been a foreign correspondent since 1977. Covering Russia and the Soviet Union, among other things. And he has won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. That was for the reporting he did on the reunification of Germany. And he's here on the campus to talk about Russia tonight on in a Millercom talk. So anybody who's in and around Champaign-Urbana is certainly welcome to attend. Of course, questions are also welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about being a foreign correspondent. You last spring taught a seminar on the subject, and you've been a foreign correspondent for a long time. And it seems that the kind of correspondent that you've been, someone who has some background in the place that you're reporting on, and has the opportunity to go and actually live there for an extended period of time. It seems to me that we see fewer and fewer of those kinds of reporters, and that we're seeing more of what sometimes in the trade is called parachute journalism. That is, someone goes in, there's some big story, someone goes there, spends a day or two, does some reporting, and then they have to either go back to where they're based more permanently, or maybe there's some other place that they go. And that makes it very difficult to put stories in context, and context is very important. What's happening with the craft of the foreign correspondent?
I think our craft, we have 44 foreign correspondents at the New York Times, has been changed, like everything else in our lives, by the end of the Cold War. During the Cold War, it was fairly obvious which places were important and which places were not, and to some degree, conflicts were more predictable and manageable. Conflicts did not break out by chance in places like Kosovo. We never, you know, the Russians, the Americans would have quickly put an end to that. The world was a more controlled and place, and easier to explain. I think since then, we have all had a difficult time figuring out what is the story. What are we looking for in the world? We change our assignments very often. You know, we've just added, we're going to have a permanent correspondent now in Indonesia. We're going to have a permanent correspondent in Colombia, in South America, because these places have emerged as important centers of news. So at the same time, we're always forced to send people on temporary assignments to places where things happen that we didn't anticipate. The world is not functioning in predictable ways. But we are trying to avoid the problem you describe, having only sort of parachute correspondents coming in. We are changing the assignments. We're, reshuffling people. We're getting far more economic correspondents out there, people who try to focus on economic issues in Asia, in Europe, in South America. We are making an effort to give a bit more depth, but the places where news break out are not often places that, we have been keenly aware of, like East Timor, now West Timor. Mm-hmm. Crises break in the damnedest little corners of the world, and even Kosovo. I don't think we could have anticipated that it would grow to such dimensions. And yet, as I say, we have opened new bureaus. I think Colombia is especially important. The United States is investing a huge amount of money now in the anti-drug war. It's a dangerous place. The reporter we'll be sending is a very brave young man, but it's a story that has to be covered, and we feel that somebody has to cover it by being there full time and not coming in for, brief little junkets. Hmm.
We have time for at least one more caller here. We have somebody standing by in Urbana, and we'll go to line number one for that. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is a little maybe frivolous, but I'm wondering, as someone who likes to travel and who hates tours, asking him as someone who's familiar with Russia, what's the best way to go and feel like we're getting a real feel for the country? It scared me when I read that St. Petersburg is the murder capital of the world, and yet I don't want it to put me off from going there. What do you think?
I think you should go.
Yeah.
I think, there is a lot of crime in Petersburg and Moscow, but there is most of it is fights among gangs and fights among mafias. It's not things that would affect you as a tourist. But it is a bit tricky to travel in Russia outside a group. I would still probably recommend finding a small group of like-minded people and making something of a group tour out of it, simply because the various facilities we're accustomed to, just don't exist there. It's not that easy to function on your own, to get tickets to things on your own. And you're better off with an agent, a tour agent who would help you. Russia still hasn't come too far in developing its tourist or travel industry. Rent-a-cars are very difficult. Train tickets take work. Plane tickets take work. Everything takes work. But you can make your own little group and go and have a great time. And I would recommend trying to get away from the big cities, Moscow and Petersburg, and checking out places like Vladimir, Kostroma, some of the ancient provincial cities, which are stunning and now accessible.
Okay. Thank you very
All
much.
Right. Thank you for the call. Bye. Just recently, the one source of some friction between Russia and the United States was the interest of the United States in building a missile defense system. And this caused some difficulty in the relationship between Russia and the U.S. and also between China and the United States. Both those governments are very concerned about this. And now the U.S. has decided to put this on the shelf for the moment. But at one point, it was said that President Clinton was going to make a decision about whether or not to implement such a thing. The testing of the system has not been going well, and now he said, this will be for the next president, whoever the next president is, to make this decision. So for the moment now, it's not such a big issue. But it seems likely that that's going to come back. Will arms control issues continue to be a serious point of disagreement between Russia and the United States?
Well, certainly if the United States goes ahead with a national missile defense, it will be, because the issue is a very complicated one. It sounds so tempting. We will build a defense and nobody can touch us. In fact, every effort in history to build, you know, walls that will protect you from the Chinese Great China Wall to our own defenses have never succeeded in that. And so the decision was reached back in the 1960s that the best defense is to make sure that each country would get destroyed if they start a war. This is the whole foundation of arms controls. It's the foundation of the ABM Treaty. So in a way, the missile defense resurrects an ancient illusion. But I think the Russians and the Europeans and the Chinese have been enormously successful in reminding us of the realities. Now, obviously, arms controls with Russia isn't what it used to be. The demand is not as great. You can argue that, you know, who cares if we have an ABM treaty? But the real issue here is whether we want to undermine the entire philosophy of arms control, which was based on mutual threat, for the sake of something that is at best illusory. And I think the fail tests certainly prove that it's a system where the technology is still sorely lacking.
We'll see if we can get quickly one more caller. Inner Banner Line 3. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Sometimes small things tell us a great deal. In, I believe, 1925, the great history of the Russian Revolution, written by Leon Trotsky, was banned. And I also believe H.G. Wells called it the greatest military history ever written. When was that reprinted in Russian, in Russia, if you know, and does anybody read it?
I'm afraid I really don't know the answer to that, or whether it's read. I can tell you that there was a huge rush to produce banned works in the beginning during Glasnost, but they quickly actually lost interest because one of the things we found in Russia after people tried to catch up with the past was that the present was so enormously important and pressing that the infatuation with reading books that were previously banned, previously a taboo, waned. But on Trotsky's work, I'm afraid I really can't tell you.
Okay, well, thanks.
All right. That's where we're going to have to leave it with the, again, further reminder that our guest this morning, Serge Maiman from The New York Times, will be giving a talk on the Russia's Fate. That's the title. And that will be tonight, 7:30, at the Levis Faculty Center. This is a MillerCom event. It is free, open to the public. Anyone who would like to attend is welcome to do that. And you might also, if you're interested in the book that he mentioned, his book, Echoes of a Native Land, Two Centuries of a Russian Village, which tells the story of a village in East Central Russia from Tsarist times through the present. That's published by Knopf, came out in 97 and should be available if people want to seek it out, bookstore, library.
Sure, it's out in a paperback, vintage.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It was very interesting.